Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I get to have a conversation with Bill Holston today. What a perfect time to be having you, Bill. Happy March.
Thank
to you.
You.
Happy Bill, March with your, yeah, with I want to talk with you as we did in our pre-show, talking about the United States here in 2020. Here we are at the end of March of 2020, and it appears to me that the rule of law, what I'm 71 this year, and you're my younger brother before me, and so the rule of law meant something when we were growing up, had what I thought was a definition, a hardened definition, but it does not appear to be so now. What are you seeing, and what's your perspective on this?
Well, I put it a little differently. I believe that the rule of law is holding steady, but it's under extreme threat and pressure. The reason I say that is because in the field of immigration, this administration has ignored international law, international norms, as well as statutory law for the protection of asylum seekers in particular. And many of these actions have been challenged in court by, by advocacy organizations. And to some extent, that's been successful. You're seeing, of course, ultimately a lot of these cases, and a lot of these cases haven't made their way all the way from the district courts to the courts of appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so we'll see, that's the ultimate test of whether whether the rule of law is going to prevail or not, is whether or not the Supreme Court, and to what extent the Supreme Court permits threats. Are violations of our clients' legal rights.
Exactly. Because under the law constitutionally, immigrants and even people who are here without documentation have certain rights.
Absolutely.
Correct?
I wear a t-shirt. Anytime I'm not wearing a coat and tie at work, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says immigrant rights or human rights. And that's unfortunate that the protection of rights is now considered sort of a liberal matter, but it's really not. It's what we are doing as an organization is helping our clients pursue their legal rights. And people will say, well, why don't the people just, get documented? Well, that's because it's very, very difficult, and it's virtually impossible to do it without an attorney. But that's what we do. We recruit and train lawyers, and that's what they're doing, is they're going through whatever the legal processes are in order to obtain legal status for our clients. So we're operating wholly within the law to do that.
I see.
Yeah, and I actually to back up a bit to agree
Please.
With you is that I thought you'd like that.
Lovely to be agreed with about. Oh yes, you have an agreement with me. Oh, do please go on.
is that in fact the Constitution has due process protections for immigrants, and so these laws that we've passed, which provide procedures for deportation and procedures for asserting your asylum claim, those are established by congressional law, and that's within the context of due process. And so one of the principles of due process of law is that if you have a process, if you establish legal rights, then you have to administer those in a fair way, and not in a way that's just giving lip service to those rights.
Right.
And that's one of the ways we've seen this undermined this year. Is I'll wait for your next question, and we can go on.
Please. Continue.
No, that's all right. I was finished. Thank you.
Well, but this is what I I'm interested in. I mean, you know, I have an interest in this, and I'm an actual interest in it. I am an immigrant. I was born in Mexico. My mother had married into a family in Mexico. I came here. They divorced, so I came here at age 4. Mm-hmm. Was naturalized at age 6. There was a mm-hmm. process that went through. Now, so in I guess I was a precocious dreamer at that time, and mm-hmm. but there were laws that were in place about what we had, and not everything had to be challenged. Mm-hmm. What it feels like to me as an amateur from the outside, it feels to me that the laws. That the court system is being used as a weapon against, like anything gets challenged up there that makes it difficult for things to happen. And that's what we're seeing it from an amateur from the outside standpoint. I'd love to know what you think from the inside.
Oh, I think that's absolutely accurate. The way I put it to people is that. You know, I've been doing this work since the late 1980s, and it's always been difficult. But particularly immigration court. Immigration courts have always operated. There's some, which we should talk about in a bit. It's always had a political component, an element of political unfairness in the immigration courts, but it's always been adversarial. But the U.S. The INS and now the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, it used to operate like a bureaucracy. And so, if, for instance, going back to your naturalization, if you did the things correctly and accurately, then you were successful 90% of the time. Almost all the time. But now everything is adversarial. The people admitted the USCIS, ICE, Executive Office of Immigration Review, every single component of this is operating in an adversarial manner. And as opposed to looking and saying, hey, is this somebody trying to cheat the system and we want to eliminate that? It's more like, can we find a way to deny a benefit to these individuals? And they're very, very, very technical analysis going on by the government for the purposes of denying benefits to people. And it's made everything, every single thing we do, harder. And just to be real frank and clear about
please.
It, in my opinion, the reason for that is because the people in charge of these policies, not necessarily the people administering these policies,
absolutely.
But the people in charge of these policies are white nationalists. And so there is a racist motivation behind these changes in policies. And, you know, that's a big change. And I'm not saying every individual in the system is a racist. Obviously, that's not true. You have asylum officers and people that work for USCIS and immigration judges and, you know, individuals that are doing the best they can in this context to follow the law and to do it fairly. But the people in charge of this are not. Their motives are exactly the opposite. And I've never seen anything like that before.
Well, you know, the thing that my wife, Melissa, says that she said that she thought that in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected, that there was a tectonic shift and that began to resonate out, and it began to broke the scabs off of some of the original sin of what our country that had never been healed brought it. All right. So then it's exacerbated by the internet, exacerbated by this. And it brings us up. Then we also have the misogyny that's just built into this with having the perfect storm of Hillary and Trump. And it just brings it up to the top. And so what it appears to us, at least, is that he is the symptom, not the disease, and that this is being brought up for the country to deal with as a country. This is our time to deal with this original part of what we're doing. What are your thoughts on that? Where do you see that we're in alignment or not from your experience?
Well, I definitely agree with the with that general idea. I'm going to approach it from a positive point of view.
Would you please?
Which is that I think we're actually in many ways examining that heritage and tradition of racism that goes way back even before, you know, not the founding of our country, but during the colonization of this country. I read Kendi's book, Stamp from the Beginning, Ibram Kendi's book, Stamp from the Beginning, earlier this year, and it talks about this history of racist thought that goes all the way back to the very early days of colonization, and how that has permeated our thinking and our practices. And, of course, the most grotesque manifestation of that was chattel slavery, but it's been manifested in many, many different ways. And I think the positive side of this is you've got old, you know, I'm a 63-year-old white man who grew up in Mobile, Alabama. So I was completely immersed and indoctrinated in racist thinking from birth. And if you've got a guy like me who is looking hard at my own bias and my own prejudice and my own racist background, trying to confront those things, that's a very positive thing. And I know a lot of people like that. Now, there are lots of other people that have thought that, Martin Luther King came and he had a dream and we established that dream and we're not. And they're the people that are fighting very hard to say, no, we're colorblind, we're past that, we're past those ideas, why are we even talking about this anymore? And that's the battleground over race. And and I think the people that I'm talking about in charge of our government are not those people. Those people have they're not saying they're colorblind. They see color clearly, and they have a white nationalist agenda to keep people of color out of our country. And but there's a lot of other people that they don't want to admit that they might be racist or they have racist ideas or bias, you can educate people like that. And there's a lot of people, and that's a very positive thing. But it seems at the moment that the dark side of this is winning.
Yeah.
And we're
at the moment.
I like your wife's analogy to a scab. I think that's true. I think what happened when Barack Obama was elected, it was a scary time for all these races, and we're seeing a real backlash. You know, it was such a proud moment for us as a country that we elected an African-American president.
Yep.
And that now we're experiencing the backlash of that.
You know, Bill, the thing that I love about your perspective is, and especially our conscious and unconscious biases. People look at me when I tell them that I'm Mexican, and they go, "You don't look Mexican." I say, look, what you don't understand about Mexico is that it's not a race. It's a nationality. My family is French. My family is French. Yeah. But in Mexico City, you go from the blackest of black to the whitest of white.
Yeah.
And so it's just not that way.
There's synagogues in Mexico City because of there's a lot of immigrants. These Afro Mexicans, and of course, there's all the indigenous people. You know, Americans. We're prone to overgeneralize and simplify, and the world is a lot more complex than that.
And it's because even though I grew up in the Jim Crow South, I actually saw water fountains, and I actually saw movie theater entrances that said colored, and I would ride on the Continental Trailways bus, which is what like Greyhound Continental Trailways, and it would go from Houston, Victoria to Houston, and we'd get off in Houston, and there would be separate waiting rooms.
I mean,
this was in my lifetime. This is when I was a teenager, and so I saw that, and you saw some of that, or at least some resonance, even though you were younger than I, in that time in Mississippi. But the so this has not been that long ago. If we look at it in any phase of which, but even though I grew up in a very liberal thinking, my mother was a very liberal thinker, and I thought I had all this healed. And then one day I'm watching a Star Trek episode, and I see Jim Kirk kissing Uhura when they're forced to kiss, and I realized something came up inside of me, and I went, what the hell is that? It was completely thinking it was all there, but it was underneath in my consciousness, in my subconscious and my unconscious.
Absolutely.
Was brought up, and I went, wow, boy, I have some work to do.
Yeah, we all do. I want to, if it's okay, I want to get back to your original question. I brought us into this area of racism because I think it's really important to point out the why we are in this moment right now. And
please,
why
you, Bill.
But the thing about the rule of law, I want to talk technically for a moment about the things that we're seeing that are violations of the law and actually some ways that we could address that when we get on the other side of it. The biggest, well, I would say it really falls into two different areas. One is the immigration courts. You know, it surprises people. I talk to a lot of high school groups, and I say, hey, you know the three branches of government? They say, yes, executive, judicial, legislative. I said, courts. Immigration courts, what branch of the government are those in? They're like, the judicial branch. I went, that's an excellent answer. It's wrong. The courts are part of the executive branch, which means that they're subject to the leadership of the attorney general. And that's a big problem because that means that the attorney general of the United States can bring direct pressure and influence into those courts. And we've seen it in a lot of different ways. In the last 2 years, when Jefferson Beauregard Sessions was the attorney general, he did something that's permitted under the law, but it's very unusual. He would take case law that benefited immigrants, and these are cases that came out of the Bureau of Immigration Appeal. Well, since he's the head of the Department of Justice, he can refer those individual cases to himself for review and then overrule them if he wants, which he did in a number of cases. The most striking of them is this case called the matter of ARCG, which was a case that I'll back up a second and say to get asylum, you have to show that you have a well-founded fear of persecution because of your race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. The first four appear fairly straightforward. The last one, that membership in a social group, is a group of people that have a characteristic of something they can't change about themselves, and that's what most obvious example of that is homosexuality, and the places in the world is very dangerous to be an out homosexual. But this matter of ARCG said that women from Central America who have experienced domestic violence and been able to escape their abuser because the governments, you know, grant these abusers impunity and they don't, you know, they don't seriously enforce any kind of laws protecting victims of domestic violence, that's a social group. And that definition applied to lots of Central American women, and that was one of the things that was driving the migration of women from Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, was this rampant femicide and levels of domestic violence. And that And so advocates were using this matter of ARCG to obtain asylum for their clients, and Sessions referred that to himself and overruled it. So this was a direct attack on the rights of these individuals, and it really illustrates a weakness in the whole system, because courts should not be subject to political influence. You should never be in a position where the attorney general is the prosecutor and also the judge. So that's probably the most specific example. And then
okay,
there were
let me,
other more.
Can I interrupt you here? Because a couple of things that all right. Now, what would be a fix for that? Could Congress do a legislative fix for that?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up. They could create court designated courts like our bankruptcy courts that are special Article I courts, and then that's under the Constitution, and that isn't truly independent. Bankruptcy judges, they're not subject to that kind of political influence. They're calling balls and strikes in administering the bankruptcy code and the case law that comes out of the bankruptcy courts. So if you did that, it would eliminate that problem.
Well, that
and
is
that's
a
what
clear.
A lot of advocates are, yeah, it's a clear, and it's frankly, there's really only one argument against that. It was two, I guess. One's legitimate, one's not. The legitimate one is that it costs a lot of money, which it does. Justice is expensive.
Yep.
The other one is more sinister, which is that, well, we want to have political influence over these courts. Well, of course you do, but that. Quit calling them courts, because a court is a place where a judge sits in. There's a reason there's a blindfold on that scales of justice, that lady holding the scales of justice, supposed to be blind to political influence, blind to prejudice, and administering laws fairly. And that's not going on in immigration court today.
Wow. When you look into and the only thing I'm going to ask you, Bill, because we only have about 6 minutes left, is that would you please, we have barely talked about this subject, and would you please come on again and let us dig deeper into what we're talking about. But let's, when you look into the eyes of the people at HRI and these kiddos that are coming up, going on in there, what is impelling them, what excites you, what about this new wave that is coming in, and what's weighing them on their minds?
Well, I'll say two, that's a great question. I'd say two things. One is, it's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this work. I am constantly inspired by our clients. It makes me really angry when I hear immigrants disparaged, particularly asylum seekers, because my experience has been these are the bravest, most resilient people that I've ever met in my life. And they have already overcome insurmountable odds just to get here. The other
right.
thing I'd say is there's a reason they come here, and it's not the reason that gets often sort of accused to them, that they're here to take advantage of our so-called generous welfare benefits. That's not been my experience. They believe in immigrants believe in the values of the United States more than native-born Americans. They believe in our Constitution. They see what it's like to live in a place without freedom of speech. They see what it's like to live in a place without freedom of religion. They know what it's like to live in a place where the police are completely corrupt and you can't trust them. And they view the United States as a place that's free of all those things. And of course, we're not. We have some tax on things like corruption, or not everybody gets complete protection of the law. But in general, our system has worked to protect people, and they see that they're attracted to it, and of course, they're attracted to our robust economy as well. But I'll just give you one example. This was a young man that came up in the surge of unaccompanied minors in 2014. He was a 14-year-old boy escaping gang violence. This was back in the previous administration, which I'll bring up to illustrate that the previous administration did a lot of work
as
well. Yeah, and this kid was getting rushed through the courts. But we managed to go to court and get him a special, which was a lot of work in a very short period of time, get him a special immigrant juvenile status visa. I have a picture of him coming and picking up his green card in my office, okay? Then about a year ago, he showed up in our office again. Now he's this big, scrapping 17-year-old young man. He's showing me a video on his phone of him playing soccer for his high school and how he's hoping to go and get a college scholarship playing soccer at a major university. So this is a kid who started with nothing. I mean, just nothing. And he worked so hard. And, you know, all he wanted was an opportunity to be safe. And that's what our organization does. We work really hard at pursuing for their legal rights to get status here so they can be safe and then they can prosper because they have everything it takes to be successful here in the United States if we just give them an opportunity. Inspires me. It inspires me every day.
Thank you. And thank you. And this is, Bill, we have so much more to talk about because this is the opportunity. Because when I look at the side of a freight train and I look at all the graffiti on the side of that and I go, good God, man, we can take that. That's who I want to hire. I want to hire somebody who will work that hard and do that diligent on their own to create art. And let's get that person into our.
That's great. That's a great. Yeah, because they're like these moving paintings. A lot of ingenuity and creativity there. Totally. Yeah.
And they're all done, and it's there. It's baked into that ethic, and this is this purpose. It's part of who we are. We as leaders get an opportunity to be able to pull that out. Anyway, we want to talk about not only all that, but I want to talk about how you recharge and how you get down and bring in how you're growing as a human being and as a man there and what you're looking into the eyes of these kids that are coming to work with HRI and then also the kids, the clients. There's so much more I want to talk about, but Bill, thank you for having this introductory.
Thanks so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I look forward to our next chat.
All right. Thank you, everyone, and come back, and we'll put it out on Blog Talk Radio to let you know the next time that I get to have a conversation with Bill Holtzman. Thank you so much, Bill, and we'll talk with you soon.
Absolutely. Take care.